Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's August 22nd of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, have you ever wondered if putting solar panels on your roof is worth it? We'll speak to a Denver-based economist who worked through those questions for his own home. And a grand jury investigation is underway into the actions of Denver police that resulted in a non-fatal mass shooting in the Lodo District in July. CityCast Denver discusses how the city responded. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC News headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown. After that is a public affair with Jim Williams of the Community Foundation of Boulder County. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead this morning, but first, these news headlines with KGNU's Chiara De Mare.
Boulder County Public Health confirmed that a man over the age of 65 from Longmont is the first human case of the West Nile virus in 2022 in the county. Boulder County health officials diagnosed him after reporting stiffness and pain in his joints, fever, chills, abdominal pain, and body aches. Symptoms of the West Nile virus typically appear 3 to 14 days after being bitten by an infected mosquito and can include fever, extreme fatigue, headache, and body aches. Skin rashes and swollen lymph nodes can also occur. The Gun Violence Prevention Organization, named after former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, will be in the Denver metro area today. The organization will host two discussions with officials and partners with a focus on boosting turnout this fall with gun safety messaging. This comes after the Rocky Mountain gun owners filed lawsuits against the town of Superior, the city of Boulder, Louisville, and Boulder County over their new ordinances to restrict the sales of high-end capacity firearms and magazines within their jurisdictions. The first Giffords event is at 9:30 a.m. in Thornton, and the second is at 4:30 p.m. in Denver. Giffords' senior advisor and former Congresswoman Debbie McCarcel Powell will be the moderator for both events. Speaking at the first event will be Representative Jason Crow, State Senator Brittany Peterson, and State Representative Yidra Carvo. At the second event, speakers include Senator Michael Bennett, State Representative Jennifer Bacon, Jason McBride of the Struggles of Love Foundation, and local advocate Angel Armstrong. LGBTQ civil and legal rights advocates are urging the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold Colorado's Anti-Discrimination Act, banning businesses from turning away customers based on religion, race, or sexual orientation. Groups including the ACLU of Colorado and Lambda Legal filed Friend of the Court legal briefs late last week in response to an ongoing lawsuit filed by Lori Smith with 303 Creative. 303 Creative is a web design company that is asking the court for permission to refuse service to same-sex couples. Lori Smith's counsel, Alliance Defending Freedom, says Smith's argument is based not on discrimination but on having to express the ideas she doesn't agree with. The case comes after a summer of highly politicized decisions from the conservative-leaning U.S. Supreme Court. Basalt Police arrested Newcastle, Colorado massage therapist Nathaniel Gordon last November for multiple counts of sexual assault on his clients. Now, police have arrested his boss, popular Basalt chiropractor Dave Jensen, on the same charges.
A grand jury indicted Jensen on 21 counts for allegedly directing clients he deemed, quote, hot to Gordon. Jensen is also accused of creating a work culture that encouraged egregious behavior towards women and enabled Gordon to sexually assault his victims. Police took Jensen into custody on Wednesday, and he's been out on bail since yesterday afternoon following his first hearing. He could face consecutive life sentences for up to 10 of the charges. A representative at Jensen's practice, Willits-based Wynn Health Institute, told KDNK during a phone call that Jensen is expected back in the office on Monday. The representative declined to provide KDNK with additional contact information. The Aspen Daily News reports that Jensen's next hearing is scheduled for September 7th. For KDNK News, I'm Morgan Neely.
Boulder County has launched a new website to help those impacted by the Marshall Fire and windstorm disaster. KGNU's Christian Garibay has more.
The Navigating Disaster for Boulder County program launched a new website last Friday that will help Boulder County residents with disaster relief. This website is free and offers short-term support for residents, such as recovery after a natural disaster event, and long-term support, such as rebuilding after initial recovery from these disasters. The Navigating Disaster Program assigns a recovery navigator to families and individuals to provide one-on-one support. These navigators will help expand a family's resources by referring them to multiple services and providing aid with legal documents. To learn more about the website and the available services, visit BoulderCountyNavigatingDisaster.gov.
For KGNU, I'm Christian Garibay.
The forecast for today is mostly sunny with a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 3 p.m. The National Weather Service warns heavy rains could create a risk of flash flooding in burn scar areas. The high in Boulder is 83 degrees with a low of 56 degrees. Wind speed is calm and there will be 77% humidity. In Denver, the forecast for today will be partly sunny with a 20% chance of thunderstorms after noon. The high will be near 84 degrees and the low will be 56. And in Fort Collins, the forecast is mostly sunny with a 20% chance of thunderstorms after 2 p.m. The high will be 82 degrees and the low will be 53. The humidity level is at 90%. For KGNU, I'm Kiara Damari.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. The newly signed Inflation Reduction Act aims to boost the economy while transitioning the country to greener energy. The new law includes extended tax incentives for homeowners looking to convert to solar. While the solar energy market isn't new, prohibitive pricing has kept many Americans from getting solar panels. Dr. Daniel Kaffin, a professor of economics and a fellow at the Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute at CU Boulder, says increased tax incentives and a substantial price decrease in the past 10 years is changing that. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with Kaffin to find out who should seriously consider going solar.
So, Dr. Kaffin, I know that you just got solar panels installed at your own personal home. Tell me about why you decided to do it and what the process was like.
Sure. So when we were thinking about getting solar panels on our roof, our goal was really, can we produce power at a cheaper price than what we're paying for if we bought it from the utility? Even if we couldn't cover our entire energy usage, if we could just offset some of that really expensive midday electricity, then that would be worthwhile. And so first of all, we checked to see, do we have enough roof exposure to be able to even put up panels to start where the trees were and other buildings. And so once we cleared that, then we said, okay, well, it looks like we can put them up there. And then at that point, we contacted three different installers.
Since solar is a relatively new industry and a lot of people don't have prior experience, how should you know what company to go with?
Yeah, which company to go with is a tricky one. I think after we had a first quote, we went to the second one and said, hey, we could get this. What can you do for me? So cost is obviously a relevant consideration. We definitely played off the installers against each other. And in fact, the final installer we went with said, we're not making much money on this one. So if there are multiple retailers, it doesn't hurt to shop around and ask if they can do better or not. So we asked them for a quote. We asked them to size the system. We said, well, how large of a system can we put up there? They tend to size the system to cover 100% of your energy usage. Well, it's an easy thing for them to calculate. I would encourage people to think of it more in economic terms, like offsetting 100% of your bill is not really the goal. It should be getting your electricity at the cheapest price you can get it. But the basic price per kilowatt of production was roughly the same across the three. So we had three proposals from about $20,000 to $30,000 in terms of total installed cost. And so we selected the one that we liked. Once the financial details were set up, they came out, the company installed the panels on our rooftop. Then
can you tell me what is your monthly payment look like? You know, paying for the solar panels in monthly installments and then whatever leftover energy cost you may have. How does that compare to your energy bill before you got solar panels?
Sure. So I think our monthly payment right now is in the neighborhood of $150 a month, which is roughly equal to our monthly utility bill, give or take. Our system is a 6-kilowatt system that is very typical of residential rooftop solar systems. I should mention the other piece of the financial puzzle there are the tax credits. So on our previous home, we filed our taxes. We said we installed this system. And at the time, the federal tax credit was 30%. If your system has an installation price of, say, $24,000, say that's the system cost, which I think is pretty typical of systems on single-family homes, that's essentially a $6,000 check that you effectively get back at the end of the year on your taxes. One of the neat things is that because they monitor your energy production, you also start paying a lot more attention to your energy consumption. So I'm much more aware of, for example, how much energy my air conditioner uses, or how much energy is being used if all the lights are on upstairs, or if I turn the thermostat up a little bit higher, you know, what that means for my average energy consumption during the day. So they give you tools to sort of monitor both the production and consumption of energy, which I think is pretty neat.
So what are you using most energy on? Have you had any moments of clarity since you started paying more attention?
The dryer. The dryer is a massive energy user. We had a power outage and it flipped over to our backup battery that we have. And the very first thing we did was sprint down the stairs to shut off the dryer because that would have drained the battery in like 15 minutes or something like that. So after that, air conditioning is the other major user. And then we have a little oven that we use to heat up the kids' chicken nuggets. And that thing uses lots. Those are sort of the three things that I can see on my app that when those things are running, you know, we're using a lot of energy.
Really? How much energy does a dryer use? Like, how much should I charge someone to use my dryer?
Yeah, great question. So let me see. 6 kilowatts is about what my dryer was using last I checked. And if I run it for an hour, that's 6 kilowatt hours. So that's like 75 cents, maybe a buck.
And what about air conditioning?
Depends on the size of your air conditioning unit a lot. Like that's it varies a bit more, I think, than the dryers do, but roughly on that order per hour, maybe 50 cents an hour to keep your air conditioner running.
Okay, so 50 cents an hour times 24 hours. I was contemplating whether or not I should leave the air conditioning on for my cat earlier this summer when it was really hot outside. So
Now is your cat worth 50 cents? Is your cat's comfort worth 50 cents an hour or not?
I think she's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit more with these time of use rates, though. This is where the utility companies want people asking that basic question. If you're paying during the peak hour, say it's like 4 o'clock in the summer, that air conditioner might be costing more like a buck or a buck and a quarter an hour to keep running.
So I know also that if you produce more energy from your solar panels, you can then sell that energy to other consumers. How much energy can solar panels on top of someone's house produce if, say, the house is vacant? And how would you sell that energy? What is that process like?
So that's generally referred to as net metering. So we were on vacation. So this was sort of an experiment that we ran as well to look at what we could produce in power when we were running with just the bare minimum of, you know, a refrigerator plugged in, basically. So we were producing about $6 of surplus electricity every day when we were gone on vacation. So yeah, $6 a day, that's $180 a month of just electricity production. Yeah.
So what is the bottom line when it comes to getting solar panels? What do you tell people when they're trying to make this decision?
Yeah. So, you know, I've had a lot of friends who ask about solar. They're interested in it. They know I work on the topic and have them. So part of the choices come down to things like, just like you're making a decision between, say, owning a home and renting a home, putting solar panels on your house versus buying electricity from the electricity company has a similar sort of own or rent flavor to it, right? In one sense, the utility company, you give them a check every month for $130 or whatever it is. You don't really have to think about it too much, right? On the other hand, you can put solar panels on your roof. That's now something you own, right? That's an asset that you have to think about and they have to maybe take care of over the long run. But it's also, you own that asset. If you sell the house, the solar panels go with the house. We sold our last house. And the owners were really happy to not really have an electricity bill. That was something they, you know, factored in when they purchased the home. So it's a little bit like renting versus owning, right? If they've got a good southern exposure with a good roof pitch, not a lot of obstructions, you know, Colorado gets a lot of sun. And with those tax credits, I think it makes sense for a lot of single family homes. I would say there's one other op that's becoming more popular, which is known as community solar. community solar gardens. That's the term that they like, community solar gardens. And these are sort of solar co-op systems where individuals who maybe live in an apartment don't have a roof that they can put solar panels on, or are in a single family home that's shaded most of the time. They can join these community-based solar, and essentially it works like a co-op. They pay into the co-op and they get a share of the production from the community solar. So there's sort of different models that work for different people. I think a lot of people still have that mental model of solar being crazy expensive relative to other sources. But the fact of the matter is the cost of solar at the utility scale and the rooftop scale has come down dramatically in this last decade. And so what does it mean for homeowners? What's the bottom line? In terms of air quality, which I think is something that people think a lot about when they think about environmental, especially here in Denver, where we have concerns about ozone and recent talk of EPA downgrading our status. From an air quality standpoint, solar panels are pretty good, right? They offset a lot of power that would have been generated primarily by natural gas plants. Solar and wind, for that matter, have pretty substantial benefits in terms of improved air quality.
Dr. Kafin, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Daniel Kafin is a professor of economics and a fellow at the Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute at CU Boulder. For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
Around 1:30 a.m. on July 17th, just as the bars and nightclubs were letting out in Lodo, Denver police confronted an allegedly armed man and shot into a crowded street in Lodo, injuring six innocent bystanders. The city's response? Ban food trucks from the neighborhood. In this week's CityCast Denver, host Bree Davies sits down with Westward founder and editor Patty Calhoun to get some historical perspective on the persistent late-night issues in Lodo and hear her thoughts about what's actually causing the problems and how to fix them.
So, Patty, we're going to talk about what's going on in Lodo, but I'd love to do a quick timeline of the most recent events. What's going on with this latest debate about what to do with Lodo?
The most recent debate started after the July 17th incident where at Let Out, which is right when the bars are letting out a little before 2 a.m. and everybody crowds out of the streets at once. So during Let Out, there was an altercation. Cops were going by. They saw these guys kind of fighting, looked like one had a gun. And so three different cops wound up firing at him to subdue him. He never pulled the gun, but it looked like he had one. He didn't brandish it. They did hit him, although not fatally, and really it took three of them to hit him. Seven shots and six innocent bystanders were hit in the process. So you wonder, wasn't there a more appropriate way to deal with the situation? And in fact, according to the lawyer who's representing the suspect who was shot and has been charged, none of the things were by the book. The cops did not follow their own protocol. And you would assume their protocol calls for not firing into a crowd in a way you'll hit six people.
Yeah, maybe there was no warning, folks. You know, I know how chaotic that scene can be at Let Out. You don't know what's going on.
Right. But it's one thing if a guy is pointing a gun at you. It's another if someone thinks he's got a gun. So you've got to assume there was a better way to handle it. And certainly you would hope for better marksmanship. Even if there weren't a better way to handle it, better marksmanship.
Than shooting six other innocent people.
So since then, the calls to do something about Let Out have been renewed. Now, over the past year, of course, since there were problems at Beta and just a couple blocks away, 1900 block of Blake, there have been more patrols downtown. Beta's been closed. A couple other problem places have been closed. So the Denver police have been paying more attention. But in this case, it doesn't seem like that extra attention paid off. So now we have the city taking steps. The very first step while they're investigating the shooting is to get rid of the food trucks because it's a bad idea to have people sober up before they go home.
Yeah, I was going to say, as a former patron of Lodo, while the food trucks weren't as prevalent when I was hanging out down there in the late 90s, early 2000s, we usually would head off to a diner. Those are all pretty much closed. So not giving folks options to do that, like you're saying, sober up, or at least, I don't know, get some food in your system, calm down, meet up with all your friends.
Be in a line for a reason as opposed to milling around in a parking lot. We have done stories on problems at Let Out for three decades. And the problems have been similar, except the food trucks are a little newer because
right.
They weren't as prevalent before, as you said. But bars let out between 1:30 and 2. People are congregating. They're talking to their friends. They're shooting the breeze. They're shooting some other things. And 18th and Market was a real hot spot 20 years ago. Depends really on where the hot clubs are, but it's all within about an 8-block
That's
radius.
What I wanted to set up for folks is like why Lodo is becomes this concentration of folks when the bars close. Because there are obviously other bars all over the city and there's other areas where there are collections of bars, but Lodo's really a concentration of bars.
And it's not just the bars, they're music venues and dance clubs too. So you've got a bigger group of people. You have smaller ones, say 10th and Broadway, where you've got some clubs, and that is a hot spot too. You'll remember 20 years ago, there was the Jeff Truax shooting by Denver cops there, and Denver police weren't allowed to moonlight at those clubs because they were so troubled. And that came up again at Beta last year, that Denver police weren't allowed to moonlight there because it was such a troubled spot. So we have other trouble spots around town, and it usually is not just a lot of bars, but a lot of bars that also have huge crowds inside, like Beta.
So it's those bigger capacity spaces.
Bigger capacity spaces and places to gather. So in Lodo, and by Lodo, we're now 15th and Market used to be a real hot spot because of bars. Not so much anymore because neighbors have gotten involved. But 5 years ago, everyone was concerned about 15th and Market.
Right, right. Well, and you're also talking about something I was thinking about was, again, when I was going out, you know, gosh, 20 years ago, it was closer into around the Larimer Square area. And there were bars. I mean, there still are bars on Larimer Square, but that it, there were bigger, there was Club Purple, there were clubs. So it's like kind of moved around, but it's still in this lower downtown area.
Which has really always been the entertainment district. So when Lodo was created in 1988, even before Coors Field came, it became the new hotspot. Before that, it had been Glendale.
I mean, oh, that's right.
And I'm sure there were plenty of episodes in Glendale. But then, so 10th and Broadway became a hotspot and remains that way for club goers. Sobo has become, you know, First and Broadway has become a hotspot, although we hear less about trouble down there.
Well, and I think you're right in that there's like HQ and the High Dive and some spaces, but those are not holding anywhere near the amount of folks.
The sheer mass.
Than like a Beta building
size. And there are not really many parking lots to congregate in, or there are other places to go. You can go to, there still are some late night pizza places you can go stand in line.
Yeah.
So there's more action on that street to move away. But in Lodo, the party just continues. Interestingly, food trucks had never been mentioned as a culprit or shutting them down. One of the things that has been floated for decades is staggering let out so that you don't have every bar close at 2 a.m. You have, you could have some bars close at 3. You could have some bars close at 4. And that would at least stagger the crowds coming out.
Wouldn't that just sort of flood the next bar? You know, if someone closes at 1, everybody leaves that bar and goes to the next bar, and then those folks are overwhelmed, and then it just like continues the problem. But you think that staggering would at least allow folks to it just be less volume at one time.
Right. And other cities have certainly done it. Other cities have later closing times and some have staggered closing times. And at a certain point, some people just really want to go home. So right. They might go to a bar that closes at 1. They might go to a bar that closes at 2. And they just want to go home. Now, if bars close at 2 and they want to keep partying, they drive to Glendale because Glendale still has bars open till 4.
So again, the food trucks have been banned from the Lodo area on the weekends.
Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturday nights, and only from certain blocks, like below 19th, they're fine. So if you're hungry, you could go a little further south. But we interviewed one woman who has started a petition to say, you guys didn't talk to us, let us back. And she parked in front of Herb's Hideout at 2057 Larimer. Popular spot,
yeah.
Tiny little club, great live music club. And she did a huge business there. Without notice, she suddenly had to move. She's moved a couple blocks up Larimer. She says, I just don't do the business because there aren't as many clubs in the 2200 block.
Yeah, I see on the surface the idea of getting rid of food trucks, but it feels so unfair to punish these small businesses, especially folks who have been through a pandemic because of, honestly, misconduct by the police.
And in fact, food trucks were so in demand during the pandemic because that's how bars could stay open. They had to have food somehow,
that's right.
Remember? So these food trucks have been working so hard to stay in business. And now the police blame them. It's not like the passersby were hit by tacos and burritos. They right. were hit by cop
by
bullets.
Cops.
Now, the scapegoating of the food trucks just seemed wrong. We need to think of some better plans. Staggering let out is definitely one option to look at.
After I spoke with Patty, we got a couple of updates about the July 17th shooting. First, Denver District Attorney Beth McCann announced that she will ask a grand jury to investigate the incident. Second, law enforcement did release that body cam footage we talked about. You can see officers circle around the back of a crowded Greek food truck and approach two men who the police say were in a fight earlier in the evening. One of those men appears to pull a firearm out of his sweatshirt pocket, and that's when the cops open fire.
Hey, no, no!
Stop it!
Stop,
stop it.
I'm sure we'll be talking more about this as DA McCann's investigation develops.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Chiara De Mare, Christian Garibay, Claire Purnell, Alexis Kenyon, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then it's A Public Affair with Jim Williams. That's just after the news headlines from the BBC.